We're going to be looking at Psalm 73 this morning and continuing in our study through the Psalms, kind of an overview or maybe a greatest hits going through the Psalms. And before we begin, I just want to say my friend Steve Summerall is here somewhere, my colleague. So Steve and I work together teaching at a spiritual formation program, and I'm like a Padawan and he's like a Jedi. So anyway, it's an honor having you here this morning, Steve. So I had a little bit of an epiphany yesterday. I was helping my daughter with her math homework. And think about that just for a second, because it is July and she's doing math homework, right? And this is because my daughter, well, I'm proud to say, is very good at math. And has decided that she wants to test out of eighth grade math. Now, I'm not saying that she's like a little Isaac Newton or anything, but she's pretty darn good at math. But more to the point is she goes, oh, to teach myself math this summer? That sounds so fun. I was like, Patty and I are like, where did that come from? But anyway, so at this point, though, well, you know, she's going into eighth grade. I'm still ahead of her in math, which is nice. I know that's not going to be the case, just like I know my son will eventually get stronger than me. My daughter's going to pass me up in math. But right now, I can help her, and we were working on her homework. And she was stuck because she was getting an answer and was going, this can't be right. I'm doing everything the same way I've done it. Everything's checked out all along, but now I'm getting this answer. And we kept looking at it going, why? Why are you getting this answer? Why are you getting this answer? Until we realized finally that we were doing it right. And that the problem was, up until this point, all the numbers we were getting back were whole numbers. And you know how like a math textbook is going to do this? It's going to like lob you kind of some slow pitches right over the plate at first. But as you move in complexity, at some point it stops doing that and you start getting remainders and decimal points and fractions, right? It just, in other words, gets messier. It gets more complex. And at first we thought that must mean we're doing something wrong, right? It's got to fit in these nice little boxes, when in fact you go, no, it's teaching you how to do math, and not just math in the textbook, but math for real life. Because how often in real life do we get whole numbers? Generally speaking, there's a string of variables that go along with it because life is more complex. And my point, this was my little epiphany today, is going, I think this is what I love about the Psalms, is that there's very few whole numbers when it comes to the Psalms. It's messy. And they're filled with all these decimal points because nothing fits exactly right. And I wonder if that's kind of the point. And that I think often Scripture, but especially the Psalms, aren't just teaching us what to think. They're teaching us how to think. And it's kind of backing us up a level, right? It's teaching us not just knowledge, but it's teaching us wisdom. It's teaching us how to exercise discernment when life gets complex. And so I think we have to read these things not just simply for the universal truths that we draw out, which is super important, but also that we get a chance to watch these things intersecting in the real life of the people writing them. And that we almost learn on a more fundamental level by watching them as they're moving through the complexity. We see their hearts change. We see them discover along the way. And in fact, what we're going to see in our text today, we even see moments of revelation occur. And this helps us pay attention to those revelatory moments in our own life. And it also allows us to benefit from the work that they've done. That the writers of these Psalms often talk about things they've been shown. And as they present them to us, it kind of puts us a step ahead in a way. And then we can take these truths and we can test them for ourselves. But responding to the complexity, I think that's one of the invitations that we get, and that the Psalms teach us how to think well. I mean, we're told in Scripture that we need to love God with our mind. And I like how Lewis points out that doesn't mean you need to be an intellectual. It does mean you got to use everything you got. So it doesn't mean you need to score a certain point on an IQ test, but it means whatever you've been given, you need to use well. You need to think carefully. You need to use discernment. And to exercise that wisdom is something that I think, if we're honest, we know we live in a world in desperate need of. Plenty of people out there claim to have the right answers, But I think what we so often see is an ability to think, an ability to discern, an ability to listen and to grow. And one of the greatest things I think we see in the Psalms is people that are able to grow in their spiritual knowledge, in their depth of understanding, to move deeper and further in. Psalm 73 is a psalm of wrestling, and it's a wrestling over what the author considers to be an injustice that he's witnessing, even to the point where it seems like God's promises aren't holding true. And so he's going to bring a level of questioning there that I think is healthy for us to realize our doubts, even our protests against God, are welcomed. That God doesn't shun away from this. He doesn't rebuke us as like, how dare we doubt? But instead, often responds to those questions in a way that brings revelation and oftentimes humility with it as well. Our psalm is written by a man named Asaph. And we kind of piece together his story from different places in Chronicles and all of that. And I don't know if we always know that we've got the same Asaph, right? It's like these names can sometimes appear at different places. But it's thought that he was a Levite, that he was appointed by David as one of the chief worship leaders or an assistant to like the right hand or at the right hand of the main guy. That Asaph may have just been recording David's psalms, but it seems to point to the fact that he was the author of these psalms, especially I think the next 10 from 73 to 83. And that Asaph, we're told also in 2 Chronicles, is the one who dedicates the temple after Solomon builds it. So assuming this is the same one, he may have overlapped the two kingdoms. He may have served in the temple under David and then later his son Solomon. And if that's the case, I think he must have had a unique view of both of these very different kings. And what we see Asaph lamenting over in this psalm is the apparent thriving of the unjust. And if we look at David's reign or we look at Solomon's reign, we see wonderful, noble things about both of those time periods, but we also see plenty of corruption. And we don't know specifically what's being referenced here. But I think as we go through it, you'll go, number one, is there anything new under the sun? And here we are once again finding ourselves in a world similarly where the unjust can not only seem to endure but to thrive. And as we, as followers of God, seek to live lives of integrity, it can seem like we're doing so almost at our own harm, that we're missing out. We're going to talk a little bit about FOMO this morning. That feeling like maybe there's something missing. Maybe that the way that we've been told to live comes with a sort of loss of the good. Almost as if God has been withholding something. Or that the truths of God, the rules of God, are more of an oppression than a way to experience the abundant life. Let's read. I'm going to read the first 14 verses of our psalm. Follow along with me if you could, if you would. Psalm 73. Truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For they have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek. I think that was meant as a compliment. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily, they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. Therefore, his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. And they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked. Always at ease, they increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. All right, I think as we look at this, well, what I want to say is as we talk about not just what to think, but how to think, I think there's some things that we learn right off the bat. Asaph is going, look, there are commands in Scripture. There are even promises in Scripture that don't seem to be holding true. I think of like in Proverbs 10, it says, blessings crown the head of the righteous, but violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked. The name of the righteous is used in blessings, but the name of the wicked will rot. The wise in heart accept commands, but a chattering fool comes to ruin. These sort of things suggest a world where justice reigns, where actions that bring harm or bring pain into the world are met with consequence. They're corrected right away. We can see the effects, but if we're honest, oftentimes we see what appears to be the very opposite. We see the things that seem to be bring the most pleasure in this world being enjoyed by others, where it seems like we that are following hard after obedience, that it comes at a significant cost. And I like how Asaph says here, all right, I'm envious. It's just so honest. And I think oftentimes we tend to not be in our prayers or when we, even when we're alone, we do this sort of editing. I think oftentimes it's very comfortable to stay with secondary emotions like anger. We get mad and we point the finger there. When really, when we take a step back and look at the root, we go, you know what? I want what they have. Or even if we don't want it, we think there's something missing. There's something not right. And I say this because I want to give you a couple of these like tips as we go on how to think well, on how to love God with our mind. And I think the first one is very simple, but it's that we need to be emotionally honest in our prayers. And that means that we need to be doing that sort of inner work and looking at, okay, what's really going on in my heart? I remember somebody saying to me one time, it's not fair, Jeff, that people get to like go out and party at the Dirty Bird on Saturday night and then show up to church the next day like everything's okay. And I thought, oh, that's so honest. And let's be even more honest. You wish you could go to the Dirty Bird on Saturday night and like just go crazy, right? And if you were there last night, I'm not judging. I'm just using it as an example. But can we somehow get the best of both worlds, right? Isn't that kind of the dream? That is it possible that we could somehow enjoy the pleasures here and now as well as sort of the eternal comfort and security? And what Scripture points us to again and again is that these things are at war with each other, but sometimes, at least by appearances, it doesn't look so. But I think just to understand and to look to our emotions allows us, I think, to get deeper to the seed that's there and to understand the deeper longings, which I think we're going to see throughout our Psalm Asaph unpack. But along these lines, I just want to throw up a little quote by David White here, who I really am enjoying. He's a poet that I think has done real good work in kind of introspection of the heart. But he says, what we recognize and applaud as honesty and transparency in an individual is actually the humble demeanor of the apprentice. Someone paying extreme attention to themselves, to others, to life, to the next step, which they may survive or they may not. And someone who does not have all the answers, but who is attempting to learn what they can about themselves and those with whom they share the journey. And I like how David White points this out. He's saying this sort of honesty is the key to this journey, which absolutely all of us are on, a spiritual journey of discovery where the goal is becoming more and more like Christ, which means going deeper and deeper and deeper into his love. And to understand that requires humility, and the best way to start churning up humility in yourself is to take a good, honest look at what's going on in the heart. And to be able to name these things, it's amazing how much power is removed just simply by noticing yourself doing that. That when you're envious and you go, oh, I'm envious, so much dissipates just in noting it. I think it's said that like the anxiety is cut in half how important it is that we have that level of self-awareness. In the next part of this, he's going to transition in, and he's going to start. He has this moment, this revelation that's going to happen to him, and it's going to happen, as it turns out, in the sanctuary. And from there, he's going to walk into a perspective on sin where he's going to see it brought to its natural end, its natural consequence. I remember reading in a book called The Gift of the Jews by Thomas Cahill, where he was saying one of the things that the Jewish people gave us is a different understanding of time and of history. That up until then, that time was seen as entirely circular. It was fall and then winter and then spring and then summer and then back to fall. And life just kind of went around and around and around. And he's saying the Hebrew people gave us this idea of life as a journey from beginning to end. And seeing our life not just as a revolving cycle of years or days, but that there was a pattern or a trajectory over the life, and that we could look to the end and really determine not just as something good for today or for tomorrow, but ultimately in the end, what is going to be sustainable and good to our chief end, to our deeper purposes. And this is, I think, what Asaph is going to do, is he's going to connect, the way he's going to see through this sin is he's going to connect it to its ultimate end and whether or not these things truly fulfill what they promise. So let's read Verse 15. He said, If I had said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. And when I thought how to understand this, it seems to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I discerned their end. Truly you set them in slippery places, you make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. Like a dream when one awakes, O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in the heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast towards you. Okay, so there's a little conglomeration. Let me kind of unpack this for us. And I want to go there towards these chief ends. But before we do, I think Asaph is writing this psalm with a little bit of relief because he's basically saying, I almost lost it. I almost fell apart. I almost fell into despair. And he starts off with that going, I almost stumbled, right, in verse 2. My feet almost stumbled. And then it kind of bookended with this. He's going to say in 15, I almost betrayed our children. And it's an interesting little, you know, point about ideas and about thoughts and about our process, but I think it gives us a good little reminder here that as we're working through the difficulties or working through the troubles or the questions of our hearts, that often those are best brought before God and probably not best unpacked in front of our kids. Are you with me? That so often we can, without thinking about it, parents, voice things in a way that lacks care and concern to sort of the fragile hearts of those around us. And he's going to say this just as a point, a comment, but I think it's a good warning for us to say as we're navigating our own way and we find ourselves sometimes in that place of despair, let's be careful about what we give voice to publicly, because it can often be damaging. Now, I'm not saying we don't model this in good ways, and we need to. We need to model conflict resolution with our kids. But if we're freaking out about the government today or different things that are going on in society, and we talk that sort of hopelessness, right? Sometimes our kids will pick up on that. And I'm guilty of it as much as anybody, to see that little worry on their hearts and to go, oh, we need to be careful of that. The second part, he notices their ends, and I like how he discovers this in a place of sanctuary. He goes into the church, and all of a sudden there, he's experiencing something. And I think what this tells me is that he is experiencing some sort of revelation from God, that oftentimes the knowledge that we have, we get through observation and making deductions, but there are other times where things are presented to us. And he goes into this place of sanctuary, and I think that there's a little tip right there in saying that oftentimes if we find ourselves searching or we find ourselves in despair, where is that place of sanctuary? Where is that place that we go to where our minds are centered on the things that matter most, where our phones are turned off, where we're not listening to the news or what's going on, and we're able to just pay attention to what God is saying. Because when God speaks there, oftentimes what he's going to give us is that thing that's going to anchor us in seeing sort of the chief end or where things lead. And this is exactly what happens to Asaph. He goes into the sanctuary, and he comes away from there with a better understanding of sin. That sin is this sort of cancer on our hearts. And that it erodes things like security. And while people may seem to be thriving, that compromise in sin creates a sort of slippery surface. That the things that we once felt like we could stand on, like a clear conscience, all of a sudden now get stuck and caught in lies or caught in ways that we try to rationalize things away. And so sin has this way of eroding our peace and security by cutting right at our foundation. He says that sin allows us to be destroyed in a moment. And I think this is true too, that there's a sort of house of cards effect that happens when we build our life out of the pleasures of this world that lacks stability, that takes almost nothing to knock down, and the least bit of hardship that comes in, some sort of sickness, some sort of tragedy that occurs in our life, all of a sudden now, the control we thought we possessed or the pleasure that once seemed so important all of a sudden is shown to be worthless. I like this one in verse 20 where he's going to say that those in sin are like phantoms according to God. And you know this, but one of my favorite books is called The Great Divorce. And in The Great Divorce, Lewis is going to talk about how this bus goes down to hell and picks people up and takes them up to heaven and gives them a chance to, you know, check it out and see it for themselves. And they all get off the bus and realize they're phantoms. They're ghosts. They didn't know it until they got there. And all of a sudden, now they step off on the grass and it hurts their feet because it's so real. And it's an interesting thing. I mean, the Hebrew word for glory has this idea of weightiness. It's solid. And this idea of what sin is doing in our lives, the corrosive nature of it, that it fights at our freedom. It fights at our ability to make good decisions. That the nature of sin is like addiction, right? Diminishing returns, but that constant need that it demands of us. This is what happens, is that it's bondage. But not only is it bondage, but it eats away at our reality. It makes us thin, right? Where the idea of following in integrity after God is creating this glory in us, which is weight. It's heavy. It's permanent. It will endure. He says, so tip number two. When making decisions, consider the long-term implications. What is the true cost or consequence? Okay, that seems obvious, right? But you realize, I was reading something about FOMO. You guys know what that is, right? The fear of missing out, which is like, they say like, if you're on social media, 65% of you suffer from FOMO, which is probably even higher. This unrest. You're sitting at home and you're thinking, this is such a wonderful evening, and then a picture flashes up and your friends are all out somewhere and you're like, my life is horrible, right? This is what this sort of angst and anxiety that we live in nowadays. So they're saying basically this, that you know, some people are going, look, we're talking about anxiety and depression, how to deal with the fear of missing out. There's a whole nother set of Google responses that go, this is how to market your product towards the people suffering from FOMO. They're so paranoid of missing out. So utilize that in such a way that you kind of exploit that thing and get them to buy more of what you have to offer. Isn't that evil? Yes. It's effective. You're going to sell more product that way. But it's evil. I mean, I think this is exactly what the devil does, right? Like looks for weakness and exploits it. And exploits it with a lie. That next thing you purchase is going to be it. And if you can't afford it, just put it on credit and you can make payments. Right, but trust me, it's worth making payments for the rest of your life on that thing because you're going to finally be happy, or you won't be missing out, or everybody else will wish they had what you did, right? Oh, happiness. This is sort of the story that we're sold over and over and over again. And so something like this goes, like, remember, it won't. Just so you know, that thing you want to buy isn't going to make you happy. It just won't. Has anything ever that you've purchased given you any sort of lasting contentment? No. And yet, we fall into that trap. And connecting things to their ends, where does this lead? This pleasure today leads to debt tomorrow, leads to consequence, leads to cost. And every single fantasy or temptation that we have, like, pretends that that last chapter on consequence doesn't exist, right? And one of the most helpful little mental tools you can use is when you're tempted to do something is force yourself to carry it out to the next day or the next month or whatever that is. What is the cost of this on my family? What is the cost of this on my health? What is the cost of this on my marriage? And that oftentimes that corrosive nature all of a sudden becomes clear. So I think we're taught wisely here to see in the end where this leads. I like this too, where Asaph is going to say there that when he fell into this pattern, well, let me just read it. He's going to say in 21, when my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you. And I don't know this for sure as I take and apply this to my life. What this reminds me of is those thought patterns that we get into where we start spiraling deeper and deeper into negativity. And he's going, I almost fell. I was becoming like a beast. Why? I was trapped in these sort of negative thought progressions. Does this happen to any of you? Because it happens to me. Where I feel a certain way, and as a result of it, I try to work it out in my head, which turns to negative thoughts and worst case scenarios, which makes me feel more negative. And so all of a sudden those emotions come in and all of a sudden start spiraling down my thought process. And if we're talking about envy, that just seems to grow in that kind of dark place, that dark spiral where he's going, my thinking was becoming like a beast, right? In other words, the very opposite of us exercising our minds and our intelligence in the best way, the gifts that we've been given by God to think carefully. And I think there's a good reminder there. Do I have a tip three that has to do with this? Beware the downward spiral of thoughts and emotions feeding negatively on each other. And I say that just as a tip, we need to catch ourselves doing it. And that, like I said before, the power just simply of noting these things when we do it. Oh, here I go. And that to name it, to see ourselves do it, can be so helpful in just reducing all the power that seems to happen in that spiral. It has a way of breaking it, just simply noticing it. There's a story that I've used before, too, that I love from Dallas Willard, where John Ortberg tells it, where he says they were walking out of a talk that they had given, and he was doing that thing that probably I'll be doing later this afternoon, going, why did I say that? Or, oh, I should have said that, or I meant to say this, or, stuck in this thing. And then he looked over, and he was walking with Dallas Willard, and Dallas was whistling a hymn, and he just went, how are you doing that? Aren't you worried at all about, what just happened? We just gave this huge presentation, and how are you whistling a hymn? And Dallas said, oh, yeah, no, I used to do that. He goes, now, I just picture that stuff like a helium balloon, and I just go, let it go. And I think, oh gosh, just that. I'm going to do that. The helium balloon thing. But so often when we are going through life and we find ourselves in these places of despair, the best thing we can do is break that cycle. We start stumbling down this path where our thinking is getting worse and worse and worse. And one of the simplest things we could do is notice it, stop ourselves from doing it. Now, where Asaph is going to go into this is I think he's going to give us the revelation that he received from God. I think it's powerful. I think it's true. And I think it's something that we can hold on to even when we find ourselves unsure of these truths. So let me read 23 through 26. He says this, nevertheless, I'm continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there's nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. So good, right? Talk about being rooted. Here he was on the brink of stumbling, on falling into despair. He course corrects. He sees where all the sin that he's envying is going to lead. And then now his mind is filled with these truths. And I kind of summarized them for us here. These 4 points, 4 revelations, I say from Asaph, but really from God to Asaph. 1, we are always with God. 2, we are being led. 3, nothing in this life will ultimately satisfy me. 4, I can count on God's strength when mine fails. And I love these truths. These are truths to hold on to. These are truths that we wouldn't necessarily arrive at on our own. They're given to us, but I will say this, we can test them. We can live our lives according to these truths and see if reality coincides. And as I read this, I go, this has proved true in my life, each one of these things. We are always with God. And we need to be reminded of this because sometimes we look around and we go, well, I don't see him. Where is he? And oftentimes, if we hold on to a truth like this, what it reminds us is, oh, we need to look a little bit broader than we're looking. And I've told you that my spiritual director, Lynn, goes, Jeff, where's God? And I go, oh, I don't know. I'm panicking. I'm feeling overwhelmed. Where's God? Oh, not here. Which means, in my despair, in my angst, in my suffering, whatever it is, my circle is getting narrower and narrower. That's that downward spiral. As our vision starts shrinking, we become myopic. In that first truth, we're always with God. Okay, he's here. It like broadens it out and we go, oh, there you are. So often speaking from the fringes, so often whispering, which God likes to do, rarely shouting, rarely a bullhorn involved. Often he's out there at the fringes going, this is where I want you. Come over here. But God's there, and it's a truth that Asaph discovers when he goes into the sanctuary and goes, oh yeah, you're here. And not just you're here, but you've been here, and you're with me. You're with me when I leave. You're with me here. You're with me in my heart. 2, we're being led. And I was saying this. In the first service, it just struck me. I was saying, I think 2 would be the hardest one for you to convince me wasn't true. That when I look at my life, I like how Kierkegaard says, we don't understand it going forward. We just understand it looking backward. But when I look back at my life, more than anything, I see how I've been led. Even through the hard times, even through the confusion, even in times where I made the wrong decision, this steady shepherding that's going on. I like how Asaph is saying it's like hand in hand, right? That God is not only with us, God is leading us, God is showing us, God is taking us further and further in. Oftentimes where I don't want to go and yet God insists, Jeff, this is where we're going. And that reminder when we find ourselves in despair, when we look at the world and go, this is out of control, you go, God is here and I'm being led. 3, and that nothing in this life will ultimately satisfy me. Hopefully we all know this, but wow, it's so easy for us to fall once again into that trap of discontent where we think there's something in this world that's going to finally give us what we want. We're finally going to find the right relationship. We're finally going to find the right success and achievement where, oh, I've reached that goal. Now I have total catharsis and peace, right? And you just go, no, you won't. Look at every single testimony you've ever heard, and people are going to say, there is nothing in this life that ultimately satisfies that. I didn't say this in the first service, so this is a little bit of a bonus, but I was watching this TED Talk. Has anybody seen this TED Talk where this EMT talks about at the point of death, people are concerned about 3 things? So interesting. Nothing to do spiritually, so to speak. It's just this guy gets up and he goes, I've been with so many people at the point they're going to die and they care about 3 things. They want to know that they can be forgiven. They want to know that they're going to be remembered. And they want to know that their life has meaning. Is that interesting? Everyone is looking for those things. And I thought, Those are the questions ultimately where satisfaction lies. Anything in this life that says you're going to get it through pleasure and it's going to be some sort of material thing that you get, it's just not big enough. Nobody at the end of their life wishes they had accumulated more of any of those things, right? It's always going to be relationship, meaning, and the way that we lived. I like how Lewis in The Way to Glory is going to say, when you realize that nothing can satisfy your appetites, it means you're made for somewhere else. And I love that reality, going like, look, you have a heart made for eternity. Ecclesiastes says that. God has put eternity in our hearts. And so we long for those things, ultimately of eternal value. And so everything in our life now just points us there. And anything that we try on this earth to turn towards a chief end turns into an idol and, as Lewis says, breaks our heart. And so that reminder, there's nothing, the psalmist says it so beautifully, whom have I in heaven but you? There's nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. And that last statement, like, God is my strength, I think maybe the hardest of these to live out. Because generally, we find any of these, we find it out through action. We find it out through obedience, right? We would love to know and be reassured of these truths beforehand, but generally, all of these involve us stepping out in some way. But this last one, I can count on God's strength when mine fails, is a really scary place to be. When you're at that place and you're thinking, I've got nothing left to give. When you're at that place and you're thinking, I'm about to, if God doesn't show up right now, I'm going to fall on my face. Has anybody felt that before? This is terrifying. And yet God is going, I'm your strength. Get in there. And to minister from that is totally humbling because you realize how really little it matters what you bring. You know, you bring these little loaves and fish and God's like, yeah, it's plenty. That it really is not about our gifts, but what God can do there is something much deeper than any of us are capable of. And on a heart level, right? Like deeper than any of us can reach, further than any of us can go. He's going to say this at the end of this psalm. He says, for behold, those that are far from you shall perish. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. But for me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all your works. And two things. First off, this idea of remain near to God. I mean, if there's a takeaway from any of this, it's just saying, God, stay near him. He's already there, but your heart, your attention, your gaze, stay near to God. The other thing that's interesting to me about this, and I think we see this again and again in the Psalms, is that there's truth and reality that the psalmist hasn't grasped yet. And he kind of finishes going, you're going to stick it to the wicked. And I think, oh, Jesus is going to come and show you so much more than that. And that you have a psalmist here yearning for justice, as he should. Justice is good and godly. But the greater truth is even greater than that. And Jesus is going to go, you've heard it said, love your friends and hate your enemies, but I say, love your enemies. He's going to give a story of the prodigal son where this son that has like lost everything is going to be returned home and extended forgiveness. And I think sometimes we can have a little bit of a dangerous heart of justice that's incapable of welcoming back that son who splurged his inheritance on all the wrong things. And that the love of God, the revelation that we get through Christ, extends the message of this psalm even more, saying there's more than just justice. There's compassion and mercy. That justice will fully be realized with Christ on the cross in an act of unconditional love poured out for us. We're going to bring it to a close, but I want to just encourage, if anyone would like prayer, that we would love to pray with you about any of these things. If you find yourself on the verge of struggling or discouraged, if you find yourself defeated by things that are going on that don't seem just or seem right in the world, if you find yourself longing for hope, we would love to pray with you. And I think one of the greatest gifts we have as a church is being able to join with each other in these moments and lift each other up.